Hello, everyone. Welcome to a special edition of the Teach Forex Network podcast. We are taking questions from St. Xavier University here in Chicago, Illinois. With us, as always, Eric Johnson, Jessica Wirace, and myself, Scott Feiereisen. So let's get right to it, Eric. What are the pressing questions of the day from the young minds at St. X?
All right, man. So we got a lot of great ones here. They've been broken down into several categories: advice, challenges, successes, academic and instructional. We're going to start with the advice section here. And the first question is as follows. As accepting a teaching position is a commitment and one to be embraced, how do you know the school is the right fit for you before entering into a contract? Are there signs to look for? I like this question a lot. Maybe Jess, you look really excited. Start us off.
I was literally just going to throw it to you. I was like, this is an Eric question.
I do have a lot of thoughts on this because I went through a very detailed process to make sure that my school was a good fit for me. I had, as I was reaching the end of grad school, I had a relatively insane Google Sheets document with every single school I interviewed at, observed at, knew about, might be interested in working at, encountered. It was color-coded. Some of the stuff that you even think about before you enter the school, like commute time, reputation of the school. I listed the people I knew that worked at those schools. So I had this giant database that I was drawing from even before I really was stepping foot in a lot of these places. But then my next step is, you know, take the knowledge that you get from observing at the schools. And if there's a school you're interested in, you should seek out additional observations. So like our school, you know, I was observing at our school before Jess was around. There's a good chance actually, Fire, that I sat in your class and neither of us really registered it, because as soon as our school was on my radar and I knew that I was really interested just based on what I had heard about the great environment in the social studies department, I made it my mission to get to know people. I had a mock interview with our former department chair, and then I visited like a lot. I tried to show up and spend time and really make my interest clear. And, you know, I was just really looking to see that everybody in the department got along and was supportive. That was my number one priority, because the school I student taught at, the teachers were miserable. They didn't talk to each other. And so I was just like really trying to spend as much of my time in building, getting to know people, seeing how things worked as possible, and then putting it in my color coded spreadsheet. But by the time I was like making my decision on the school, I mean, it was really set in stone. If I didn't end up where I'm at, I think I would have been really heartbroken, because I was really invested and I had spent a lot of time doing that initial legwork. I don't know, Fire, Jess, do you guys have other thoughts on this one?
No, yeah, I think because I was lucky enough to student teach at the school that I'm at now, I literally firsthand saw how everyone kind of interacted with each other and collaborated with each other. And that's what like drew me to our school, because I was just so enamored with like the people that were there, the relationships that had been built. I literally felt like I was at home, like I with these people, and I had only known them for a couple weeks. And it's like crazy to think about how fast you can make those connections in a new environment. But that's what really drew me in. So I think really, if you don't like where you work, you're not going to like the work you're doing. So it's really, really important to think about the people that are going to be around you every single day and have the same kind of similar mindsets that you do in terms of teaching. You know, sometimes a different mindset is cool too. And it's nice to have different perspectives, but you want to have and to be surrounded by people who are going to motivate you and continue to push you into being a great educator, which is why we're here, right? Because my two amazing colleagues.
Thanks. Yeah, absolutely. Fire, you got any additional thoughts?
I would say just a combination of the two. So as well as Jess, I student taught where I was at. So that made the feel of the chemistry of the department easy to, you know, kind of segue into. And then just to piggyback off of what you said, Eric, just you got to get into that school and like see how things are going above and beyond. Obviously, your research, the data and the performance and the student body and the, you know, the community, all that stuff. But like you got to get in there and see what the vibe is like and see what the environment is, because it could be dramatically different than what the data portrays, or just it doesn't quite encompass the culture, the climate of the school community. So getting in there and just seeing how it operates is big.
I really concur, Fire. The school I student taught at is like highly well regarded. It's supposed to be amazing. And I was really hyped to student teach there. And then I was miserable. And all the teachers were miserable. And I tell my grad students now that if they don't, you know, if they have the privilege to be able to take their time in the job search, which not everyone does, I was really lucky that I did. I think this is the most, absolutely most important thing. I think if it weren't for the people around me in our department, I would have quit in 2018. Absolutely. Our next question is another good one. This is a classic one. And maybe let's start with Fire and then we'll hear from Jess. What is the one piece of advice you wish someone had given you as you started your first year as a teacher?
Oh my gosh.
It's a big one. It's like deceptively simple, but it's a big one.
Yeah, gosh. Boy, well, that was back when we were still using flash drives. So that was just getting over that and then learning Google Drive. I was like, wow, this is terrific. Boy, the first year, I would say get good at something first. Like get good at one, have one great class first, you know, like I taking on five classes and coaching and all that, it's a lot, and you're going to be incompetent in at times just because there's so much you're taking on. Like it's going to go kind of screwy, but you know, can you focus on getting good at this first and then kind of get that running? And then let's move on to the next thing and then get that. Maybe it's just one class period at a time or one day at a time. So really, you know, kind of boil it down into that and keep it simple. I think my first year I tried to do everything. And if you try and do everything, then it just kind of, you know, you're not doing anything well. So I would say that, and all that comes from a good place. You're trying to impress, you're trying to get things done. You know, you want to be the person to do it. But like, just take it easy, you know, and if you get one class operating like perfect, and then if you could move on to the next one within the year, that's like amazing.
Yeah.
So I would say, you know, that might sound like low expectations, but I think that that's realistic.
I like that a lot, Fire. And Jess, I want to hear from you, but I'm going to cut in because mine's really relevant to what Fire had to say. Mine is, and this is unique. I was trying to think of something different. Is try to find ways to make the infinite work finite. I think that's something I really struggled with as a guy that likes to check stuff off a list. And that's really helpful for the way I think. When I started teaching, I nearly had a nervous breakdown when I realized that the work literally doesn't end. You can always make the lesson better. You could always plan further ahead. You could always grade more or give more detailed feedback. And that was like, I literally had a moment as I was preparing over the summer for my first year teacher, sitting in my parents' front porch, like an indoor gazebo type thing, looking over a world studies textbook, realizing, oh my God, I actually could never stop working and still not be done. Like I could do this forever. And so really aligned with what Fire is saying in terms of like getting good at one thing, I also would challenge new teachers to give yourself permission to set endpoints for stuff, whatever that means for you in terms of planning or grading or when you work. Build some sort of wall that allows you to know when it's okay to stop, because otherwise it's very easy to run yourself to the ground. Jess, what do you got?
I mean, I agree. When I read this question, it's funny, I think I'm going to show my age, but I thought of this TikTok song where the girl's like, it is never that serious. It is never that serious. And I think that resonated a lot with me, because I feel like when I first started teaching, I took everything super serious, and I had to grade every single bell ringer. I had to grade every little worksheet. I had to make sure that everything was pinpoint perfect. And that's going to drive anyone to insanity very quickly. So it's never that serious. You know, sometimes if you don't grade a certain assignment, that's okay. If your lesson doesn't go exactly how you wanted it, that's okay. If the video does not play the way that it needs to play right away, that is okay. So I think giving yourself grace and giving yourself that like mindset where if things do go wrong, it's fine. It's not that serious. The kids probably won't notice sometimes that you are not doing what you thought you were supposed to be doing. And they're actually very, very forgiving. If you are very straight up with them, it's like, look, guys, this is not how this is going. Let's reset real quick. They'll usually be like, okay, that's fine. You know? So I think it is never that serious. And, you know, everything will have one way of working itself out. So just be adaptable. It's not that serious.
I wish young Eric could have heard what the three of us just said. I think that would have done so much for my sanity. That's awesome. This question is incredible. I'm really excited about this. We'll start with Jess. How did you find the right clothes for teaching that fit your personal style while ensuring you are professional? Let's go Jess fire and then I'll talk.
I really like this question. I don't know, because I thought the same thing. So, you know, I'm a young woman and I am like 5'2". And I think my biggest fear was that I was going to continuously be mistaken for the students, which I still am 100%. Still am getting asked where my tardy pass is in the hallway. But I think that I really am grateful that our school and our district really doesn't have a big dress code for us. But I think that I have started leaning towards what is comfortable and cute and still makes sure that I look good. I think that's really where I'm at right now in terms of my style. So just as long as you are, you know, covered up, looking a little like chic and professional, you should be fine with anything that you wear. So always be you know, comfortable in what you wear. I think my biggest thing this year was my ponchos. I was so geeked about my ponchos, wearing them everywhere. So I was really happy to read that question.
Fire, how do you make sure you're all covered up and looking professional?
Gosh. Well, as you know, Johnson, traditionally I've been a shirt and tie man. So that really is just because my own kind of work personality, I've got to have the clothes kind of set my mindset, and I don't like jeans anyways. So if I'm wearing like a hoodie and, you know, jeans at work, then I'm in kind of like the athletic, you know, leisure mode, home mode. I'm not in work mode. So I want to be in work mode. So I just kind of lean, you know, I feel like definitely men have an advantage because there's a lot of like athletic, casual business wear that's available for relatively inexpensive prices, you know, like collared shirts and, you know, the dress pants now are quite comfortable. It's not like it's not like you're wearing a tuxedo pants or something, you know? So I feel like it's very available, and, you know, shoes, having some sort of like the athletic casual shoes that they have now, you know, not quite like gym shoes, but something like that. And just kind of, I think the students notice too, you know, you're looking sharp, you're looking good, you're confident. But yeah, do those kind of like inexpensive options. This, since I've taken over my AD position, these are all from eBay. I buy these all used off of eBay, and I don't think I've paid for one for more than like $20-$25 with shipping. So, you know, and this is nice. It's a brand name. It's nice. It's, you know, so, you know, just those little things. And then the kids are like, man, you're always looking sharp. I'm like, I bought this on eBay and these pants are from Target. Like, I'm not, you know, but yeah, you know, it feels good.
Yeah. I like that fire. I was a shirt and tie guy. I devolved each year. I started removing the tie earlier and earlier. And then for a while I was doing the hoodie and polo, which was kind of sad looking. Now I do the unofficial social studies department uniform, which is a flannel shirt. And I'll throw a flannel over a polo, a pair of jeans. You know, I don't know. This is how I rationalize it in my role as a seminar teacher, since it's a lot more SEL stuff, Mr. Rogers type stuff. I think being a little bit more buttoned down maybe helps me connect with the students more. But that's just what I tell myself when I'm wearing the same four flannels every day over the 7 blue and black polos that I bought. That's a good tip, though, is buy stuff that matches with everything else. So then in the morning, you're not struggling. If you kind of, you know, I'm like Arthur the Aardvark. I got like four options and that's it. And I just sort of match them all together. How about this one? This is another really important one. How do you make sure you are taking care of yourself when you are having a hard day? What do you recommend for work-life balance? Fire, you know, I knew your new role has been, it's a lot as athletic director. I mean, you're basically an administrator, so I can't imagine that's been necessarily easy. How are you doing the work-life balancing, especially with a new kid as well? How's this working out for you?
That's a great question. I'm going to go back to what I said before with kind of like the doing one thing well. And I said the word competent and I saw Johnson kind of like scuff, but though, like, if you really think about all the things that we have to do that we're responsible for doing, and if my boss walked in tomorrow and said, you know what, Scott, I gotta say, you're doing a pretty competent job, I'd be like, huh, really? Wow. That's like the best compliment ever. You know how many things have, like, we've responded to and fires we've put out, and I'm pretty sure this is the best approach. And now looking back, like, boy, I really wish I would have done that differently. So, you know, when you add all that up, to say that you're doing a competent job is actually like quite, like, keep it up, you know, like that's, you know, that's pretty incredible. So, you know, when I think about that in terms of like our evaluation system, you know, like proficient, if someone said I was doing a proficient job, like, oh, thank you. Wow. Gosh, that's like, you know, that's great. So take it easy on yourself. You know, you're like, not everything, it's not possible for everything to be at that level that you in your mind have it at. It's just not possible. So, and if you kind of hold yourself to that all the time, you're going to melt down. So you've got to find a way in your own mind to have high expectations and high standards and continually kind of disappoint yourself, I guess, and still like, okay, well, I got another shot, you know, tomorrow. You know, that's a big thing with teaching. You got another shot teaching that class tomorrow. You got another period coming up with athletics. I got another season starting in March, right? So I got another crack at kind of at a new protocol or another routine that's going to be helpful. So, you know, you got to have that approach. Otherwise, you know, you're just going to beat yourself up and then you're no good to anybody.
Agree. Jess, what do you do for work-life balance?
So when I first started teaching, I was the first year teacher who would stay after school and grade papers and, like, you know, work on a bunch of lessons and always worry about what I'm going to be teaching tomorrow. And then I stopped doing that. I stopped doing that because I set myself up for basically burning myself out. And I was like, I'm not going to continue to teach if I continue to do this. So basically my thing is, I am also a very to-do list kind of girl. I set out my to-do list for the week and Monday, get it all done while I'm at work, get everything I need to do while I'm at work, while the kids are doing something, while I'm like, have some downtime, whatever, get everything that I need to. So I don't have to think about work at home. I don't think about work at home, maybe for like 10 minutes. And I'm like, oh, let me make sure to write this down or something like that. But other than that, nope, no work, nothing, no teaching, no kids, no nothing is done at work anymore or done at home anymore. And so that definitely has helped a lot in just like decompressing from the days and just making sure that I'm putting myself first. And then I think my biggest thing is, find something that you love and are passionate about and you do for only you, and do that. And make sure you do that every single day, right? For me, it's been weightlifting. Like, I didn't do something for me. I just did everything for everyone else. And weightlifting has become this thing that I do for me and for me only. It's my hour a day where I am only focused about what I'm doing. I'm not worried about anything else. And that is what keeps me sane. That one hobby, passion thing that you have, keep that anchored and make that a priority in your life. Because if not, then you're going to make everything else a priority and you're going to get burnt out and you will not be the priority. And then I guess my final piece of advice goes back to like the other day, when you two saw me bullying our coworker to go home because she felt sick, where I physically, like, well, not physically, but like,
I was almost physical. All right. I was ready. You're going to throw hands. Okay. I was waiting.
I grabbed her sack of papers. I said, if you don't go home right now, I'm going to go throw these away. And I was like yelling at her. And I was like, you need to go home and take care of yourself. If you don't, I'm going to do it for you. And so eventually she caved and went home and stayed home for 2 days and she got better. And I was like, I am so happy that you called off the next day and you went home. So always, always, always take care of yourself, because like I told her, the building is going to be there tomorrow or the next day when you come back, and nothing will have changed and you will feel better and you will be better for it.
That's great. Yeah, I echo everything else you guys are saying. I think startup and shutdown routines are really good. You know, find something when you get home from work that transitions you from work to home. For me, it's 15 minutes playing with my dogs in the yard, and that allows me to sort of reset and start the next half of the day. I also, you know, I like to joke, I don't truly believe this, but strive for mediocrity. You know, take a break, go easy on yourself during the work day. You know, it's okay if your lesson is maybe a B or even a C plus sometimes, if that means you're going to have time to grade some of those papers during the school day. I really do a lot to optimize my week, how I teach, when I teach what, so that I don't have to take anything home. And I frankly just don't. I don't take anything home. I'll grade slower and just not take stuff home. I think for a first year teacher, for a student teacher, maybe that's not feasible. But I think if you work really hard to optimize your day and your week, I think you absolutely can make it happen. And maybe someday we should have a $250 course just about that, because that's a need that I hear a lot of people talk about. I recommend David Allen's Getting Things Done book. That was really helpful for me. This is a great question too. These are all really good, meaningful questions. When you started teaching, what surprised you the most? What surprised you the most? I got a thought if you guys need to marinate.
You go ahead.
So, you know, my student teaching was weird because my cooperating teacher made me only lecture. And so behavior was not so good because you can't lecture kids every day. But when I began teaching for real and I got to implement some of the practices I learned in my teaching program at DePaul University and teaching the way I wanted to teach, I was actually really surprised the degree to which students are on your team. I don't know. I hear a lot of older, grumpier teachers complain about student behavior, and certainly it's not always perfect. And do kids get distracted? Yes. Are kids on their phones? Yes, sure. You know, there are absolutely challenges in regards to that. But to me, I found that classroom management and the behavior of students in my classes is far better than I think I ever thought it would be. As long as you're real with the kids, I really do believe the kids see themselves as on your team. And the kids do care for you, especially if you communicate that you care for them. I don't know. I thought classroom management was going to be a lot harder than it actually is.
Yeah, I agree. I honestly feel like sometimes the kids are much more understanding and like nice than some people might think that they might be. I think that that really all comes down to you being very genuine. I think that they can spot fakeness and they can spot when you are not being genuine. So I think that really, really helps. I think something that surprised me is, I guess, similarly to what you were saying, Jonas, is just how much honesty gets you with kids. I know that sometimes as teachers, we are the adults in the room, but you will be surprised how much honesty will get you with the kids in terms of how much they will respond to you. Like, listen, guys, I messed this up. Like, can we please just go and look at this, you know? And they're very understanding. And I think I'm thinking right now of the example, like a couple days ago, I, had this kid who was just being a bit defiant, and I was like, okay, like, you know, and I also went off on him a bit quick too, and you know, and he kind of called me out on it, and he's like, well, you give everybody else chances and then you right away like pulled me out, blah blah, blah. And so then I like had to like take a second, breathe in, and then I'm like, well, if that's how you feel, I want to apologize and I want to tell you that I'm very sorry if I made you feel that way. I did not, those were not my intentions, and I do want to apologize for how I snapped at you. And immediately it was like night and day. The kid went from defensive to soft, like real quick. Like he was just like, oh well, yeah, it's okay. I mean, I shouldn't have done that either. And so you'll be kind of surprised with how much honesty will get you with some of the kids, and I thought that was really cool.
That's awesome. Fire, what are you thinking?
Oh, what am I thinking? I would say I think all teachers, it's important to remember your own mindset and perspective when you were in school. And I think I underestimated that. I think other people underestimate it more than me. So what I mean by that is, you know, if we're all teachers, then we all, to some degree, liked school, right? Like we all were into it, obviously. So then, all right, what percentage of people do you think at your school weren't that into it? It's probably higher than you think, right? Like when I was in high school, it was like, oh yeah, we're all into it. Okay, great. But that's probably not so. Like I was just into it. So now as a teacher, or like having that bigger view, you have to understand that, yeah, there's going to be a lot of kids that might not be into it as much or might not really like school. And part of your job is to kind of like get them into it a little bit, you know, because get them some kind of a connection, because then that's going to help out a lot of stuff down the road. So, you know, It can't just be like, wow, I was, well, I thought everybody would be like me. Like, no, you're like 10% of the population is going to be like you. Like, if that. So, you know, thinking about that, how are you going to connect with the other 90%? What are you going to do? You got to do something. So that, I think that struck me very early. Yeah.
Awesome. I think this one might be a short question. Number six, is it a good idea to student teach at the school you'd like to work, or do you recommend student teaching at a different location? Yes.
Yes, 100%.
Right? Fire, you got any other thoughts? I think it's yes. If you want to work at that school, you can build your network at that school by student teaching there.
Yes, or yeah, it's your dream school, and you're like, oh, this is going to be the best school I've ever been to in my entire life, and I'm going to be so happy here, and then you find out that it's not. It's better to find out early than later on.
There you go.
Yeah, easy. Here we go. This is the challenges section. So this, I think this, some of this stuff might get kind of heavy. I'm excited. In your opinion, Fire, I'm going to make you start with this one. So brace yourself. In your opinion, what is one of the biggest challenges facing education and educators today? Are there solutions to these challenges?
Oh my gosh. All right. So one of the biggest, and then are there solutions? Oh my gosh. I would say one of the biggest is the amount of, oh boy, I don't know.
Do you want me to take this? I have a thought.
Yeah, you take this. You take
my,
this.
My first thought was technology. You're a professor. My first thought was technology, which is a real thing. Silicon Valley has defeated the minds of children. And when I call kids out on their phones now, especially after a media literacy unit, I don't yell at them for having their phone. I just say, Jess, you've been defeated. And the kids, I it makes them think twice. But my real thought beyond that, beyond the technology piece, is actually this. I think the biggest challenge facing educators, facing schools, facing everywhere is, I would honestly say, like the mental health crisis, especially following this COVID era. The kids are not all right, as the offspring once aptly said, and they need a lot of help. And as teachers, I think we fill in the gaps. But I am at the point now where I truly and honestly believe that every kid every year should have one therapy period that's like 50 minutes. I think that would go very far in helping our students, whether it's the high performers that are anxious, whether it's the low performers that need some, you know, re-engagement process. I truly think, I don't know how feasible this is, but every kid should be in some sort of, I guess it would maybe be a group therapy class for 50 minutes with someone trained, not just a teacher that you trick into doing this, but an actual trained social worker or therapist working with those kids and helping them out. You know, the challenge I see with that was, even if that pipe dream became reality, I think so much of the way we try to solve problems is in education is Band-Aid oriented, half measures, poor follow through, that I would be so scared even if we tried it, it would turn out crap. But I'm at the point where that's what we need. And as the freshman and senior seminar teacher, that's something I'm sort of doing a little bit, but we need that bad. So that's my kind of deep and depressing thought.
Oh, I guess to go off of that, right? Like, that would require a lot of resources and time, and that's something that we don't have. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges that we face, is constantly like time to do this, time to do that. We're loaded with 5 classes, 30 kids in each class. That's 100 and something students that you have to take care of, be on top of, think about IEPs, think about this, think about that. And there's just so much on our plates that we don't have enough time for it. I was actually just talking to two of our coworkers during lunch the other day about how much free they feel because they have a student teacher right now. And they have a student teacher who's completely taking over 2 or 3 of their classes. And the 2 or 3 classes that they do have left, they feel like they can do much more meaningful work. They feel like they can connect to the students better. They feel like they have this sense of ability to execute things at a higher level than they didn't have before. So I think it really comes down to resources, right? If we had more teachers who took on less classes overall and less students, everything that we did would be way more meaningful. But that requires money, and that requires funding, and that requires a lot of these other things in the grand scheme of systemic changes that, you know, will probably take forever to get, which is also depressing.
I've always said, Jess, if you cut our workload by 50%, like if you gave me half the classes or half the kids, one or the other, it doesn't matter which one, that would transform my sanity as an educator. Mm-hmm. Fire, what are you thinking about the problems facing
education? So how about this? I'm going to throw a question at you. Would you take If we could guarantee or do some sort of shift where we're going to get 20% better student achievement, but it's all going to cost us 20% salary or something like that. So you take away everybody gets taken away a class, but that's 20% of your workload. So we got to reduce that by you're not working as much, and where everybody gets a teacher aid or something. I don't know. Would we be up for that?
That's an amazing question, Fire. And yeah. I wish this was in the regular podcast. I would say so what that 20% improvement in student achievement means, I would love to know more about that, right? Like
that's what I was gonna say was we have to have a real serious conversation about like what do we mean by success.
Yeah. I feel like I just perked up. I'm like, hold on.
Yeah. I mean, in CPS, we're fortunate that we are well paid to the point where that 20% it would make life really hard. I mean, especially with inflation, my salary is not doing what it used to be. Okay. But I mean, yeah, maybe if that meant I was going to have an engaged aide in every class, right? This is, you know, there's a lot about the follow through piece that we could get lost in the minutia of. But let's say like it's like a physics problem or in a vacuum, you know, let's say 20% pay cut. Things at our work with our kids are just 20% better, whatever that means. Sure, probably. I think the payoff for my sanity would be huge. But that's in the fantasy world. In the reality world, I don't know how I feel about what the outcome of that would be. What do you think, Jess? Because you were perking up. You're about to jump out of your seat there. It's like, a little spring under you.
I don't know. Like, I don't. Like you said, like I gotta pay bills. I got stuff. I got things I have to pay for. I need my money, right? And people I think always come down to this big like insult where it's like, well, I thought you were doing it for the kids. I'm like, yes, I'm doing it for the children, but also I have to do it for me. Like I have to think about me and what I need to do in my life to be successful. Like at the end of the day, I love my job, but at the end of the day, it's just a job. I'm not going to sacrifice myself and my pay and what I want to do with my future to help other people's kids all the time. You know, like I think that, that's something that a lot of young aspiring teachers do is they feel this guilt that they have to put their all into it and they have to like change lives for the better and touch every single kid and blah, 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 which is great, which is nice, but that's how you lose yourself first. And that's why I feel like I wouldn't do that. I at the end of the day would probably change to a different career path where I can still influence people and help them basically, but I would do it because I need to do my stuff too. So that is my perched up, like, do not take my money. And if that sounds selfish, then it's selfish because I need to be selfish.
I don't think it's selfish. It's a job. I tell people that the teachers that do work for free devalue our profession. Fire, you got a thought on your theoretical thing that you threw at us here?
Boy, I mean, I would just say, well, I always think I kind of go back to what I said before, getting good at one thing. And I guess tied into like the problem that I see in education, the future of education is that it does seem we are locked into a system that nobody really likes. And we're all just like trudging through it. And everybody's doing the very best they can in like very bad circumstances. And we all look around and say like, boy, this has got to be different. And then everybody just like continues to slug away at it. And it's like, okay, well, why would anything be different then? So I would say if I could wave a wand, I would like to see more of like a graduated workload as a teacher or as an educator where, you know, back to what I said, you don't start with five classes and coaching. Like, no, you're not going to do that your first year because you're going to do it and you're going to do everything you can. And then in 4 years, you're going to be like a mental hard case. So, and then you're going to stop, which is defeats the whole purpose. So instead, I would like to see some sort of like, you have two classes full time, you're an aide the third period and you're coaching, and then you're paid whatever that is. And if you show you're good at that, we're going to give you a fourth class and we're going to give you a fifth class and we're going to give you a sixth class. You want to make more money? We're going to give you a seventh class. You figure out some cool way to do some online thing and where all everything grades themselves. Why would you not get paid seven classes worth? Like, who says you can't teach 200 kids? If you figure out a way to use technology to where it all grades itself, why would you not do that? I think there's good enough teachers who should have more. I think that there's teachers who are overwhelmed. Well, then why are you teaching five classes in coaching? So
that's good fire.
But you know, it's instead everybody gets that workload, and we're all over the place with it. And like, is anything even really going to plan? Is anybody doing anything good? Or are we all just kind of like, you know, we're all burnt out. We're all at wit's end, and we've got 5 months to go. And okay.
Yeah, I want to work at your school. That's I think that's really cool. How about this? But one?
Like Jess said, that's all resources and like. Yeah. Well, then you have to be able to have that control to kind of dole it out. And, you know, another thing in schools, like we are in a building from 50 years ago. Like the whole idea of education today is open and have everything open and it's all collaborative. And then we're in a building that was built like with all these little corners and you're hidden away. And, like everything is backwards to what we want today, it seems like.
Yeah. That's great. We just talked about this recently on the podcast. What's been a failure that led to an improvement to your methods and processes?
What was the question? Sorry, I was all fired up about it.
I know. And I want to talk about that more, Scott, but we got
I will
more
talk
questions.
About it a lot. I mean,
one. We only got through question one.
Yeah.
We still have like 12 to go.
Well, with these serious questions, I mean, come on. Where do you see, what's the problem with education? Like, oh man, it's Sunday morning. Yeah, I just had a huge cup of coffee.
We had talked for 3 days.
Education.
Yeah. What has been a failure that has led to an improvement in your methods or processes?
Oh, well, I just had a huge failure that I've been dealing with all week, actually. I shouldn't laugh.
You got to laugh not to cry, man. That's the hardest part, you know.
Just you know, you gotta, the work sometimes is like bringing other people in to share the decision making, and that's like extra work. So there's many times where you're just like, I'll just take care of it, and you take care of it, and you do the best you can, and then it goes bad, and then now you gotta like. Because you did it and you took it out, you know, when, and all you had to do was be like, okay, these were the options, everybody. What do we think? And then that would like alleviate a lot of other issues. And that, you know, those other people, that's their job. They're there to, you know, be part of that process. And, you know, maybe they see something that you don't see, right? Maybe that's the whole purpose. You know, two heads are better than one. You know, so you got to be the person sometimes to like bring people together and be like, hey, here's the deal. What do you all think? Okay, we're all in alignment. All right, great. And I didn't do that, and it came back to bite me. So now I gotta, you know, here's the protocol and here's the process. And next time this thing comes up, this is the process that everybody follows, and it's shared with everybody. And this is how we make sure it doesn't happen again.
I think that's a really good point, Fire, and something that I'm sort of thinking of that is aligned with that is, you know, remembering the sort of institutional politics. You know, I think people forget that, you know, they associate office politics with a corporate environment, but that very much exists in an academic and a school environment as well. And, you know, I've had situations, and Fire, you've been tangentially involved in some of these situations where, you know, you go out on a limb or you're engaged in a leadership role, and there can be repercussions when things do go awry or leaders at the school aren't happy with decisions you're making. And I think of that sort of old adage, like the tallest blade of grass gets cut. And for me, I found a lot more happiness in terms of trying to influence school policy or make change or make difference in the department, leading from the rear, but also not having a role of official responsibility. I found my time as course team lead led me to only grief because I was the guy that was responsible for stuff. And I much prefer now to be the guy sitting in the back of the meeting, sharing ideas and sort of influencing agenda, but not the person whose name is on the paper that's going to get yelled at. And I just think being cognizant of that kind of stuff, of office politics and how you want to engage with that, I think that's a unique thing to think about, because I've had situations where I didn't think about that stuff and it put me in very uncomfortable positions.
And I would say, just to build off of that, in a mindset shift that's important is, you know, focus on the decision-making process and how that would be improved, as opposed to I screwed up and I gotta fix it. Like, I'm the person, I'm doing this job. This is the process we went through. It didn't go well, and now we got to do the process better. And I think that kind of like depersonalizes it a little bit, while still you're kind of accepting responsibility and you understand you got to do something better. But it's about, that's why we always talk about these processes and protocols. And, you know, it's not about you. Like, I understand you're working hard. The whole thing is like, come up with a better process so it goes a little smoother next time. And that applies for everything in education, whether it's like your attendance policy or, you know, how you're going to deal with a behavioral issue, or, you know, whatever else you got to deal with as an educator.
I think that's great. Jess, what about you? What's a failure you've had that's changed your methods and processes?
I feel like I'll just bring up the one from the podcast, right? And I, like, I don't know, I guess from now on, I just kind of throw the kids in the deep end and call it a day kind of thing. I feel like when I had that lesson that went really bad, it's because I was so worried the kids were underprepared and blah, blah, blah. But now I'm like, it's, you just kind of throw them out there and see what happens, you know, and you'll be very pleasantly surprised that they will deliver, even if you think they won't deliver. So I think that that's definitely changed how I view some things, because I'm like, oh, this might be too hard for them or this and that. But now I'm like, nah, they can do it. They can figure it out. I'm here to help them figure it out so they can do it. So I think that that's really changed my mentality in terms of how I'm teaching or what I'm teaching, basically, because I feel like I was very much, when I was first year, coddling them a little bit, right? Like, oh no, this will be too hard for them. Oh no, like, I don't want them to feel bad. But now I'm like, no, this is what we're doing. We're gonna have high standards and we're gonna meet them, and I'm gonna throw you into the deep end, but I am your life preserver and lifeguard, so I will help you not drown. But at the end of the day, you gotta try to meet the requirements and do everything that you need to.
Got it and dig it. We'll keep working through these challenges section, and then I think we'll wrap after that, because I know, Jess, you got a brunch to go to.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna ask you guys. I'm like, you guys want to just finish the challenges, and then we can do maybe Tuesday night, finish the other
one? Yeah, absolutely.
This is so fun.
Yeah, so we got the failures. Here's question three. This is a nice one. What are some of the most effective classroom management tools you've used and would recommend? I have thoughts. Yeah, talk about the Mexican mom technique, and then I'll talk, and then we'll hear from Fire.
The Mexican mom techniques. Honestly, I just had someone come up to me, which I was pleasantly surprised. I had a student IEP case manager come visit me, and he was looking for me. I'm like, oh no, what did I do? Right. And he actually came because he's like, oh, I have this child on my caseload, but it seems to me that he is failing every other class but yours. And I was like, oh, okay, well, let's talk about what he did. And so I told him, you know, this is what he did. He did really well in our discussion. He's been doing good in his little project thing. Okay, he's doing swell. And then he goes, yeah, he has been very vocal that he likes you, but hates every other teacher. And I was like, oh. And he goes, well, what's your secret? And I was like, I don't know. Like, I just am me, you know, like, I'm just me. And I think that that really, really sits well with the students. No, there is no better classroom management than being your authentic self, because the more that the kids like you, the more that they are willing to do things for you and listen to you when you tell them to stop throwing stuff across the classroom. So I think that for me, I embody this like very old school Mexican mom persona and aura, whatever it's called.
Aura.
And the kids really respond to it, because I think that's what they know, you know, and they see that that's me and that's who I am. And that's really, really, really helps. So I think that that really is my best piece of advice with classroom management, is to play with your strengths and show the kids that you are still the adult and you can be fun and you can be yourself But at the end of the day, when you mean business, you mean business. And my kids know that better than anyone, because when I mean business, they're like, oh God, this woman is scary. So I play to that.
What I have to say is very aligned to your thinking, Jess. I think, you know, the question is interesting, this idea of a classroom management tool. I don't think that exists. I mean, you'll read articles about it. You'll read articles about strategies. But I think really your classroom management comes down to you and your style and how you interact with the kids. We've spoken on the podcast before. If I manage my classroom management using Jessica's Mexican mom mentalities and behaviors, not only would I A, be canceled, B, it would be cartoonish. It doesn't match my style, right? You know, Jess busted in to hassle one of the students that we share the other day. And it was interesting watching Jess interact with students, because it's a completely different vibe than how I do. It's not wrong, right? But it's just Jess speaking with the kids to her true self versus how I speak to the kids to my true self. And I think all classroom management comes from the pre-work you do at the beginning of the year, getting to know them, and then consistently demonstrating love and care for your students. A guy recently used a phrase to me, care before curriculum, that embodies who I am as a teacher. I'm a teacher because I like working with the students. I'm subject matter agnostic. I would be a terrible math or science teacher, but I do it because I like working with the kids. And I think, you know, I don't know about math, but I think I could manage something like science and maybe eventually excel at it, just because my number one priority is my interest in and attention to the students. I tell the students I care for them. You know, I'm there for them. I like to work with them. I like to get to know them. And so when it comes time for me to manage the class, I'm not using a strategy or a tool. I'm asking the kids to do, you know, whatever desired behavior. And usually it's aligned to the degree that the young teenage mind can make that happen. And then, you know, when I speak to my students, you know, Jess may do the Mexican mom thing where she's kind of shouting at them a little in Spanish. You know, I had some kids being real frustrating the other day in my sixth period. And my style is not to do any shouting. I called them up and I said, kids, I'm going to yell at you now. That's literally what I said. I'm going to yell at you now. And then I just told them, I just spoke to them in this voice. I said, this is the behaviors I'm seeing. I don't like this. You know, I asked them why I called them up. You guys know I called you up? No. And then I just talked to them about it. And you know what? They were slightly goobers the next day, but they were still vastly improved. So you got to do your classroom management to your style. Don't use somebody else's strategy. Use yours. That sounds really cliche, but I think there's a lot to be said for that. It's true. Yeah.
If I tried to be Mrs. Rogers, the kids would walk all over me.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Fire, you got something on this one?
Yeah, I definitely just be have detailed instructions for everything. Instructional detail. I feel that both of you are really good at that. That's something that I have been getting better at. And that makes a huge difference, because then that, you know, if everybody's kind of on task and into it, that alleviates all this other stuff. So, you know, you got to put a lot of time and effort into that. So, you know, a lot of times I'm doing a really good job this year of having a lot of stuff down in slides. Like, step one, take out something to write with. Like, it's written down on the slide. Like, it says there, it says take out something to write with. And then sometimes you still got to walk around and be like, hey, can we take out, you want to take out something to write with? Oh, yeah. Hey, do you need a pen? Like, you still have to do that. Oh, take out your U.S. history notebook. Take out this thing from yesterday. And then you walk around and like hold it in front of them. Do you have this thing? So, and like, that's written down. And that is more valuable than like spending time putting cool animations into your World War II PowerPoint. Like, that's not going to help. That's not going to. No one's sitting there like, man, I'm really into that. I was going to throw this pen across the room, but now that I saw this, I'm into this. Like, that's not helpful. So, you know, you have the basics, but have it just be so, everything is so detailed and laid out. It's like almost impossible to screw up.
I like that, Fire. And I've been telling my grad students that, actually. I tell them your like slides and worksheets should look like your lesson plans. And could double as your lesson plans in a way. That degree of detail for the students and for you, I think, really pays off. Let's do this one as the last one for the day. Question four here. What are some ways to adjust your classroom management when your strategies are not working?
Okay. So even when the Mexican mom technique doesn't, I usually like handling everything in-house, right? I don't like calling deans. I don't like calling parents. I tell my students at the beginning of the year, I'm like, I don't like calling your mom or dad. I don't like doing that because that's extra work for me. So I'm not about to do that. So we're gonna handle this between you and me. And so that's usually enough to have most kids be like, okay, like, you know what? You're right, lady. Like, I won't do this again. But other times it does need to escalate further. And that is when I levy like other people in, right? Whether it be the deans, coaches, parents, whoever I need to call in order for us to like handle the situation at hand, right? So I usually like to start with maybe like in school stuff, like, you know, dean support, stuff like that. But the parents really do help. And even just sending like a quick little reminder message, being like, hey, your kid was saying this stuff today. Can you just tell him not to do that? Then the next day, the kid comes back like a completely different person. So really levying relationships is a really, really big thing. I tell my kids, I'm like, oh, if you do not stop that, I'm going to call your mom, your dad, your aunt, your uncle, your tías in Mexico, and they're going to be already chismeando about you before you even get home. And so they're like, okay. And so that usually is enough for them to be like, okay, I don't want to do that. And I'm usually follow through too. So I feel like I don't really have to call home because of behavior issues, which is nice.
That's awesome. Fire, what about you? What are some ways that you adjust your classroom management when your strategies aren't working?
I try to assess, I guess just more talking about like the individual student issues, in terms of like classroom stuff, just considering like the time of day or and just the personality of the class. So, you know, you might have, all right, tomorrow in US history, you know, I've got three US history lessons and we're all doing the big discussion stations, moving around, you know, we're doing the full thing. But you know, your first period class, that might not be, you know, that's a tall order, right? So, you know, it might not be, oh, what can I do to get these kids to do it? Like, it's not going to happen. So you've got to think of a different way to kind of have that environment first period with everybody half asleep, and you could still kind of get everybody where they got to go. And then, you know, maybe that works then for fifth period, you do the full thing, but then ninth period's off the wall, right? So then you've got to like really, really strip it down and make sure that, you know, you have every little detail in order, or, you know, make sure that these specific people aren't in groups. So, you know, whatever you do, you've got to be willing to make those adjustments. You can't just keep, you know, beating the dead horse, as they say. I mean, if it's the early class and they all just sit there quiet, like just telling them we're going to have this huge discussion isn't okay, because that's what we're doing. Like, okay, good luck with that. So, you know, you've got to make some adjustments and do make a couple different moves in order to, you know, see what you want to see.
That's awesome, Fire. And that's the perfect, because that sort of feeds directly into my thoughts on this one. You know, I think the final thing is, you know, to take what you're saying, Fire, to level 11 in such, like, if you have a class where classroom management's a really issue, like a big problem, not like the goofy ninth or the tired first, but like if they're, you know, problem kids or a problem combo of kids, or if things are really, really challenging, you know, in addition to thinking of the context of the time of day and who the kids are, like Fire's mentioning, don't be afraid to take that class off the calendar and spend some time doing classroom management, relationship building, circles to try to figure things out. I see a lot of teachers, like Fire, you mentioned, that like soldier on through these nightmare classes or lessons not suited to the classes, and they spend all morning like, how am I going to give my Mesopotamian notes to my sixth period? And they're like crying and anxious about it because Jess in sixth period is going to flip out, you know, like whatever. And so you should be comfortable and willing, you know, if you got your sixth period that's giving you major, major issues, don't do academics for a week. Spend the week doing stuff to try to get the class back on course. You know, do a day where you do talking circles where you try to figure it out. Do a day where you bring the dean in. Do a day where you bring your school instructional coach in. Watch a movie with them, eat a meal with them. Like, there's all this stuff you can do. Don't be afraid to take them off the calendar. If they miss a week of instruction, you can catch them up on the most important stuff. I promise they're not going to die if they don't hear the same Mesopotamia lecture that everybody else hid. So you really like feel comfortable to take a class or a couple classes off the calendar and spend time trying to fix what's going on. Because I think fire, you would really, you know, identify with this idea as you sort of brought this up earlier. We in education tend to fall into that like dumb definition of insanity phrase. You know, we're doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. Teaching is the biggest profession, I think, that falls into that trap. And so step out of whatever you're doing, take them off the calendar and fix it.
I love that phrase, take them off the calendar. I like that. That needs to be like a Teach4X something.
We should save that. Somebody write that down. February 26th, Sunday, 9:08 a.m. It was made up.
Jess can scream at them in Spanish, like, you're off the calendar.
Yeah.
You guys are off the calendar. Yeah, and that's another thing, just to build off of that, because there might be kids in your class, there probably are, who are like on the radar of the school, like, oh man, these kids are. So once again, like, your expectations are for that class to be like, oh, we're all going to be scholars and academics. Your principal would probably walk in and be like, they're not setting the room on fire, like, and they're here, like, this is great, you're doing a great job. So like, once again, keep your mm-hmm. expectations in line. You know, I know we all want our best for our students, so we all want to see them do well. But, you know, there's a lot of kids where if they're just not in the bathroom, you know, flushing the garbage down the toilet, that's pretty good. You know, all right, we're doing all right. We're doing okay. Okay. Tomorrow we're going to work on those Civil War notes. But, hey, okay, you know what, we're doing all right. So, you know, keeping that in mind as well, that's kind of going back to what I said, just being competent or proficient, like, just keeping it going a little bit and keeping everybody on board. You're doing way better than you think.
That's awesome. Great note to end on. We'll be back for part two soon. We'll give advice on academic and instructional stuff, talk about successes, and maybe even some interviewing tips. Thanks everybody for watching. I think we should call this Teach4X long form. And I'm going to do the outro
form?
Today.
Oh, free form.
That sounds pretty cool too. That's a new Apple app. So I don't know if
unhooked. Yeah. Teach4X unhooked.
I like that.
Unhooked.
Unplugged. Teach4X unplugged.
Yeah, Teach4X unhinged. That's when it's just Jess talking to the camera by herself.
Yeah.
Yeah, like yelling in Spanish and English.
So I know Jess, you got some pancakes that are waiting for you. Do you want to tell people where they can find us online?
Yes. Hold on, let me pull out the little intro.
You
gotta
pull it up. Are you serious? I could do it. I don't got to look at anything.
Do it.
Okay. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. We appreciate your time with us. As always, it's been a blast. I'm Eric Johnson. We're here with Jess Widace, Scott Feiereisen, esteemed colleagues in the Social Studies Department here. Over 25 years experience combined. You could reach us by asking questions on Spotify, finding us on LinkedIn. We got a brand new Facebook page you can like and send to your mom. You can email us at teach4xcontact@gmail.com or hit us up at www.teach4x.com. We got updating videos rolling there every day. You can click on the Patreon, like, subscribe, $3 a month. Unbelievable deal to keep, you know, some snacks, some Cliff Bars in the pocket of your favorite teachers. Help us buy Jess a new microphone. She got one, but you don't plug it in. It's been a blast. Have a good day, everybody.
See you, everyone.
Come on, Jess. No document or anything.
I feel so dumb.
Come on, dude. Come on. Get on
that
my
was,
level.
That's Johnson's
that was so cool.
Back in the city, baby.
Wow. Woo!